Good morning, all. Our first case this morning is Kawasaki Tyson Kusha versus Plano Molding. So, Mr. Mead, you'll be leading me off.
Your Honor, may it please the Court, I'm arguing this case for plaintiff appellants, but only on the contract side of the case. Union Pacific's counsel will handle the tort side. There are three appellants, K-Line's agent, K-Line America,
right,
and the Union Pacific. We're appealing from summary judgment and dismissal by the district court involving the derailment of the Union Pacific train in Oklahoma, where K-Line's container, into which was loaded Eppley Plano's steel molds, caused the derailment of the train because the steel molds went through the bottom, front, or both of the K-Line container and caused the derailment and therefore the damages that we're pursuing. There were seven parties to the whole arrangement. There was one purchase and sale contract. The parties to that were Plano, a Chinese manufacturer called Kunshan, and Plano's translator and expediter, broker, whatever you would call them, CMT International, an Illinois company. There were three shipping contracts. Two of them were evidenced by bills of lading. The first contract was between Plano, who made a deal with World Shipping, a non-vessel operating common carrier, to see that the molds got from Shanghai to Illinois. That was evidenced by World Commerce's bill of lading. World Commerce is a non-vessel operating common carrier, so it had to make a contract with the vessel operator, in this case, K-Line, which was the second contract. And K-Line issued its own bill of lading, and Plano is bound under both bills of lading, not just the one with World Commerce, with whom it made the first contract, but it is bound by both bills of lading. There was then a third contract between K-Line and the Union Pacific, but there was no bill of lading evidencing that contract. The provisions of the bills of lading are in common. They're not identical, of course, but there are three clauses in each of the World and K-Line bills of lading that come into play. One of them defines what is called merchant throughout the bills of lading. Merchant encompasses a number of entities, including the consignee, the owner, the receiver of the goods, in the case of K-Line's bill of lading. And then the second clause which comes into play is the so-called Himalaya clause, the subcontracting clause, a well-known clause that gives the benefit of all the obligations, all of the rights of the bill of lading to subcontractors and subcontractors of the common carrier who has made the contract, evidenced by that bill of lading. Then finally, the key operative clause here is the loading warranty clause. Each bill of lading had one, essentially warranting that the stowage of these steel molds was satisfactory for the transportation. And in the case of the K-Line bill of lading, it elaborated a little bit, said that the molds themselves were suitable for carriage. The securing was adequate for the transportation. Plano's liability arises in three ways, we submit. The first one being the rule in Norfolk Southern versus Kirby, which is that where an intermediary in a chain of common carriers makes a contract with a second-tier common carrier, who then may or may not make a contract with a third, fourth, and so on common carrier, where that intermediary makes a contract with another common carrier, the cargo interest who I'm using Kirby's words, hired or wishes to ship the cargo, that cargo interest is liable under the terms of the bill of lading. I would call it apparent authority, although those cases who have talked about it both erroneously as an agency issue and even where correctly as a federal maritime common law issue, have not used that term. I think that's an appropriate term. When an intermediary comes to you as a common carrier and ships with you, you have a right to assume that he has the authority to act for the people for whom he is acting. Secondly, we have general contract law.
Well the Kirby case and the trilogy, as you call them, mm-hmm. Two of those cases related to the limitation of liability, didn't they?
Yes.
The most recent one relates to a venue provision.
It isn't precisely that. The Great Northern case ultimately related to limitation of liability, but in Great Northern, the lady who shipped her cargo with the freight forwarder was held liable where the freight forwarder got a rate from the common carrier, which carried with it a limitation of liability. So it's not precisely the same as Kirby, where it's surgically a limitation of liability at issue before the court. And yes, in Kirby, the precise issue, as Kirby opinion recognized, was limitation of liability. And quite a few commentators wrongly, in my opinion, and that's not a new opinion, that always was my opinion. In fact, I had some disagreement with one of my co-counsel here about it before Regal Beloit ever came out, because in my opinion, Kirby, if read carefully all the way through, as one of my idol teachers in law school taught us to do, if you read it very, very carefully over and over again, you will see that Kirby's philosophy and the observations made in Kirby apply equally to the other terms of the bills of lading, not just to limitations of liability. In any case, of course, Regal Beloit put the last nail in the coffin, if you will, by applying a Japanese law clause in Kaline's Bill of Lading, as well as the Tokyo District Court Forum Clause, leaving no doubt whatsoever that Kirby was not limited. And as I pointed out in my brief, the other side in Regal Beloit, in their brief to the Supreme Court in Regal Beloit, argued that Kirby was limited to liability limitations. The Supreme Court thought so little of that in the Regal Beloit opinion that they didn't even give it any credence. They just blew right by it and held that the Kaline Bill of Lading applied, including its choice of law clause and forum clause, which were in the same paragraph. So I think the Supreme Court panel in Regal Beloit agreed with the view that Kirby, all the statement in Kirby made by Justice O'Connor was saying was, today, here, we are ruling only on what's before us, a limitation of liability. I doubted, and still do, that Justice O'Connor meant that that was the end of the road for the agency doctrine that the court was announcing.
Let me ask you, just to make sure I understand, when you look at Great Northern Kirby and Regal Deloitte, it's your position that those cases, we should really extend the holdings of those cases to hold non-cargo owners liable on downstream contracts, right?
Well,
and that's your bottom line.
I'm sticking with what Kirby said. A cargo owner is an elusive concept, very elusive. You can't really tell who's the cargo owner. You've got the property right. You've got the risk of loss to look at. So, no, we're not saying necessarily non-cargo. What we're saying is, in the words of Kirby, the person who hired the intermediary, Kirby's words, the person who wished to ship the goods, Kirby's words, is the one. In other words, the party behind the curtain, if you will, who really made the transaction go. They may or may not be a cargo owner by some measure. They may or may not have title. Just as here, title was very murky. It was an FOB transaction. But Plano had made two payments, which went to Kunshan for the cargo. So who owned the cargo at the time of the crash? Well, maybe Kunshan, maybe Kirby. Kunshan took the risk of loss and insured the cargo, but had the property rights transferred? Very murky. So we are not saying that those cases stand for a non-owner. We're saying they don't really have anything to do with title, property, or ownership. What they have to do with is who goes to the first intermediary and asks that intermediary to move the cargo. And we say that the trilogy holds that party liable for the contracts made by the intermediary and holds them liable to the second-tier carrier and the third-tier carrier and so on down the line. Thank you. My white light came on.
Thank you, Mr. Mead. Mr. Waller.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Counsel, my name is Kyle Waller, and I have the pleasure of being here today on behalf of Union Pacific Railroad. As Mr. Mead indicated, there has been a division of labor in this case on the two issues that were decided by the trial court, one being the contract issue and one being the negligence issue. Union Pacific has agreed to take the laboring oar on the negligence issues, and we'll be discussing those issues today. In particular, why the trial court erred in its July 2011 order in finding that Plano owed no duty to either Plato owed no duty to either K Line or Union Pacific with respect to the shipment of the two injection molds. To the extent that I can, I'm going to try to get some of the agency issues, but based upon time, I doubt that I'm going to get there. If you have questions, I'll do my best to answer them. I know the court has read the briefs, and I know I've read the local rules and seen that you would try to move us along and not to repeat things that you've already read. But I think with respect to the issue and the position that Plano is taking, they are trying to pigeonhole themselves into a phrase that they consistently use throughout their brief, a mere purchaser or mere buyer of goods. And the reason they are doing that is because of three cases that they rely upon and three cases that are cited by the trial court. That is the Aslandis case, the Rickmers case, and the DiGregorio case. For that reason, I'd like to discuss some of the facts which show that Plano was not just a mere purchaser of goods and why the trial court erred in finding that no duty arose. As Mr. Mead noted, Plano contacted CMT. Samuel Wu's deposition, Mr. Wu testified, for all intents and purposes, CMT is a translator. We also find companies in Asia and Southeast Asia that can make these molds for Plano. However, we work as a translator, and everything that we do is approved. In fact, in this instance, they had two companies that they were approved to potentially use, and ultimately they decided to use Kunshan to make the molds. That was at the direction and the approval of Plano. Plano also directed CMT to use World as its NVOCC. In other words, to move in the direction of getting it shipped and getting their product to the United States. Plano directed World, CMT to use World, but did not actually have CMT deal directly with World. Plano dealt directly with World with respect to the shipment. And there are numerous issues where there is efforts of unique knowledge, an intimate relationship in the shipping, and also an exercise of control in the shipping process. They selected the size of the container, 20 feet. And if I recall correctly, Mr. Younger, who's an engineer, who's employed by Plano, selected a 20-foot container because of the weight. He also decided it should be FCL, which means that there should be nothing else within the container except for Plano's goods. And I think the most important fact with respect to the control issue is that Mr. Younger is the one that gave the directive to ship the molds fully assembled. Because you're talking about two separate sets of injection molds which weigh roughly 25,000 pounds. You take them apart, they have separate weight, and you can displace the weight. But Mr. Younger decides that he wants them fully assembled. So he's controlling the manner in which they will enter the container and the manner in which they were placed in the container. Which, under those three cases, would take Plano outside of the rule that's established by Aslandis, Rickmers, and DiGregorio, specifically that, generally speaking, a purchaser of goods has no duty to a cargo owner, other cargo owners who are shipping or any other parties because they are not in a position generally to know about how the materials are going to be shipped. I would submit to the court, the trial court erred because it didn't pay attention to any of the facts that we just discussed, and rather basically said Plano was just a mere purchaser of goods.
Mr. Waller, the size of the container and the and the form to which it was packaged, are we sure that's a contributing factor in the negligent sense to this accident?
Yes. I mean, the evidence before the trial court, and I don't think that that was disputed at the trial court level. In fact, I believe, if I recall correctly, Plano conceded for the purposes of the motion for summary judgment, just for the purposes of discussion, not for the purposes of trial when we get there, that, yes, we'll consent to that issue, that just for the argument's sake.
I understand that there's an agreement on that size issue and that how they wanted it shipped in the sense of the packaging. But that does that speak to the control of how it was packaged? I understand to the control of the size of the container, but what does it speak to as far as contributing to the negligence that caused this accident?
The concentration of the weight, because what you have is you have a 20-foot container, and you're supposed to. And I apologize, Your Honor, I can't remember what the poundage is for a 20-foot container. But the container is intended to hold that poundage throughout the entire container. And I don't remember the specific dimensions, but quite honestly, the boxes or the crates that the molds were in probably a crate about this size, maybe about this size. And so you've taken that 20-foot container, and you have moved all of that weight and compressed it into one area, which is the reason, or the argument that will be made, that the reason that the molds fell through the floor, hit the bed, and caused the train to derail.
So if a container of a different size would have a different bed, is that your point on this?
Well, generally speaking, a container is, and there's different containers, but you're talking about an intermodal container, it has corrugated steel sides. It has I-beams or cross-beams that are then on the bottom, and then there is a floor that's put on top of it. There's a corrugated steel roof, and then there are doors that are closed, and by the way, sealed. So the receiver of the cargo does not actually see the cargo inside or how it's stored. The purpose of that seal is a security issue to make sure that once it's sealed, there's nothing that's stolen before the point in time it gets to its ultimate destination. So when K-Line actually receives the container, they don't open it up. They have a security seal on that container to keep it closed so they know that they're not losing that. What Plano wants the court to do is it wants to look at Aslandis, Rickmers, and DiGregorio. Ultimately, I would submit to the court, I generally don't have a problem with the cases themselves. The rule that if there is no evidence that there was some control involving, as noted in the Rickmers case, by the shipper, that there's no responsibility, that's consistent. That is definitely something that you can rely upon. But that's not the facts of this case. And there are a serious number of facts which actually show that Plano was in substantial control of this shipment and how it was shipped and how it was packaged. Outside of that, Your Honor, the other arguments that we've made with respect to duties, generally speaking, the foreseeability issue. And also the unique knowledge issue. I see that I'm running into my rebuttal time, and I would like to at least preserve that rebuttal time. Thank you.
Mr. Wasserman.
Thank you. May it please the court. I am no expert in intermodal transportation and certainly not with respect to containers. It was my understanding that plaintiff's theory was that it was the failure to properly lash and secure the crate containing the molds within the container that ultimately caused the accident. I believe, as the papers reflect, all sides concede that a 20-foot container was not an inappropriate size container, and had the crate been properly lashed and secured, the container, if it was in good condition, would have survived the journey. With regard to the negligence claim, since I'm addressing that first, I think it's important to note what the district court did find. The district court found that there is no evidence that Plano was on notice that the parties who packed and shipped the container were unable to do so properly. There is no evidence. Mr. Waller did not speak to that aspect of their claim. And I don't think that that's the basis for their claim at this point. I don't believe they're claiming that Plano had any special knowledge that the people who actually crated the molds and then secured them within the container were unable to do so. The district court then found, nor is there any evidence that Plano was aware of a risk from concentrating the weight of the molds in too small an area. That's the basis for the negligence claim. As you heard the counsel for Union Pacific, their claim is that Plano had unique knowledge that the molds were heavy and were concentrated in too small a footprint, and that was the cause of the accident. There was no unique knowledge as to the weight of the molds. That appeared on the bill of lading. Nor was there unique knowledge as to the size of the container. That also appeared on the bills of lading. As to Plano having unique knowledge that the molds were in a concentrated footprint.
When you say size of the container, you're talking about the 20-foot
yes.
K-line container, not the crates itself.
Correct, Your Honor. The district court was correct in finding there is no evidence that Plano had unique knowledge with respect to the concentrated footprint and the threat that that would present. Plano is not in the business of shipping goods of that size or weight, nor did it participate in that process. Plano manufactures plastic products made from the steel molds. So with respect to the negligence claim, I believe the district court did get it right, and that there was no evidence that would somehow show that Plano had unique knowledge which should cause it to be liable. With respect to the contract claim, the trilogy, which is something of an invention of counsel, does not support the imposition of liability with respect to the use of an indemnification provision. And Your Honor drew a distinction which we believe is the critical distinction in this case, and we think undermines reliance on Kirby. Kirby was limited to liability limitations. We don't believe that that was an accident or an oversight. Just as when we're interpreting contracts or when courts interpret contracts, the definite trumps the general. I think.
Well, why would it be any different, though, if the intermediary can act on behalf of the cargo owner, shipper, whatever the proper title would be, merchant, in terms of limitation of liability or choice of law or something of that nature? Why couldn't that authority be used as well in terms of acceptance of responsibility?
I think the broad policy implications that would be involved if we said there was no difference create an enormous problem, and I would like to focus on that problem. With regard to a limitation on liability, limitation on liability is a cap, and that's a good thing. It provides predictability in intermodal transportation, and it provides predictability for both sides to the transaction. By way of example, for K-Line and Union Pacific, if you have the $500 per package COXA cap, they have the predictability of knowing that if that cargo is lost or damaged, their liability is limited to $500 per package. With regard to the owner of the goods, going into the transaction, if they have goods that are worth $10,500, and they elect to have the COXA limitation apply, They know that their risk in the event the cargo is lost is $10,000. They then have the opportunity to insure against that risk as the cargo owner. They can decide that we're not willing to accept the loss of $10,000, so we'll obtain insurance because we are the owner of those goods. We can obtain insurance, and therefore we will be made whole. So there's a policy reason that supports the application of liability limitations. Indemnification provisions have a much broader application, and I don't believe have the policy support that liability limitations would have. With an indemnification provision, and in this case is a classic example, a party which is a purchaser of goods, who has a future interest in goods, is being held, or they're seeking to hold Plano liable for all of the damage caused by a massive derailment. Now, as a party with a future interest in the goods, and that's where, to the extent Plano falls under the definition of merchant contained in the bills of lading, Plano at most had a future interest in the goods. Plano has no title to the goods. How does Plano insure against that interest? How does Plano gain the predictability that a liability limitation would provide when it's up against the sword of an indemnification provision? And in our papers, I believe we use the analogy or the comparison of the shield of a liability limitation, where Kirby said that where companies like K-Line and Union Pacific are faced with a claim of liability relating to the cargo, they can raise the shield of the liability limitation as protection. That gives them the predictability. The K-Line court had the opportunity to address the broader policy implications which Your Honor is touching upon. It could have said that all provisions of the bills of lading are binding on the cargo owner, or it could have said that all of the downstream carriers, such as K-Line and Union Pacific, have the benefit of all of the provisions of the bills of lading. It didn't do that. That's what Union Pacific and K-Line would have this court do, but the Kirby court did not do that. There was an opportunity for it to provide a broad general rule with respect to intermodal transportation and the applicability of all of the provisions of the bill of lading. It did not. It limited that provision to liability limitations. And the precise language was, likewise, here we hold that intermediaries entrusted with goods are agents only, my emphasis, in their ability to contract for liability limitations with carriers downstream. That's what the court said. And I think it's fair to assume that the court intended to state a limited rule.
Mr. Wasserman, in that regard, can I ask you this question? Does it remain a question of fact whether Plano consented to be bound by World's Bill of Lading?
We don't believe there is, Your Honor. We believe, and I'd like to address in that regard a statement made by K-Line's counsel. He said this was an FOB transaction. The record reflects that this was a DDP transaction.
But wasn't it designated on the bill, World's Bill, as an FOB?
It was. Yes, that's absolutely correct. It originally was.
That's some evidence of that.
Well, the problem, though, is I think that K-Line is at least required to take consistent factual positions in all of the courts it appears before with respect to the same transaction. And in the district court, K-Line did not dispute that the change had been made from FOB to DDP. And, in fact, in the affidavit submitted by K-Line's counsel, and this is in our papers, in an affidavit submitted by K-Line's counsel, they cite this affidavit was in connection with their opposition to CMT's motion to dismiss. They cite and adopt the factual claim that it was changed from FOB to DDP. So in the district court, they say it's DDP because it suited their argument there. I don't think they can come into this court and argue that it's FOB. Moreover, there's no evidence contradicting that it was changed to DDP. This is not a case where it was changed after the fact, after the accident, where you could consider whether or not there was a motive for changing it. This occurred prior to the shipping.
I guess I wonder whether that's a credibility issue. Would seem to make sense that, yes, there are documents that would show and testimony that shows there was an effort to change it from FOB, and it was incorrect that it be FOB, but it seems to me I'm wondering whether that is a fact issue that needs to be...
Well, having at least anticipated that you might ask that question, I tried to put myself in your shoes and consider the issue of credibility, because that would be a problem with respect to the district court granting summary judgment. The problem I have is where there's a credibility issue, there has to be some evidence disputing the relevant event. And the relevant event here is that it was changed from FOB to DDP. Just as, say, if the parties entered into an agreement to pay $10 per widget and then later on changed it to $15 per widget, and both sides agreed that they had done that, and they had done that before there was ever any issue with regard to a third party with respect to the price of the widget, and there is no evidence from anyone, from any source, that they didn't actually agree to change it and didn't change it contemporaneously, I'm not sure where credibility comes into play. The documents are there. No one has questioned their authenticity, and they certainly didn't question it before the district court. They're basically saying, well, I was going to say they're basically saying we don't believe it, but the problem is K-Line has adopted that because that is what happened.
Well, I guess what nags at me a little bit is the more that Plano was involved in that, the more I'm beginning to wonder whether they were merely a purchaser or whether they had some more direct role in the transportation aspect of it.
There is no question that Plano had a role with respect to the transportation of the goods. The record speaks to that. The question is the character and nature and the scope of that role. And as I tried to do through analogy at the end of our brief, I believe that role was not an uncommon role. And to the extent that Union Pacific argues that the role was extensive, it's simply the nature of ordering custom-made products as opposed to an off-the-shelf item. The character and nature of Plano's involvement was not so extreme as to render Plano anything more than the purchaser of the product. They wanted a product manufactured overseas. They went to CMT. CMT and Kunshan. Kunshan ultimately manufactured the product. They were part of the same group, the engine group, ENGINN, I believe. They're on the other side of this. CMT and Kunshan are on the same side of it. They can't be Plano's broker. But putting all of that aside, at the end of the day, with respect to contractual liability, Kirby did not craft the broad rule that the plaintiffs here seek to have this court enforce. With regard to Regal Beloit, Kirby is barely mentioned in Regal Beloit. And what I believe the Supreme Court did in Regal Beloit is it simply held cargo owners to their agreement that all disputes relating to the carriage of goods under the bills of lading would be heard in the district court in Tokyo, Japan. All of the cargo owners were parties to a bill of lading that contained that provision. And it didn't say all disputes under this bill of lading. It said all disputes related to this carriage of goods, which would encompass any disputes, whether they fell under the bill of lading or not. So in Regal Beloit, you had four plaintiffs, I believe it was four plaintiffs, who sued in the district court, not in Japan. And the court held them to what they had agreed to. I would also note The irony that the plaintiffs rely on Regal Beloit for the proposition that the provisions in the bills of lading apply to all of the parties, including Plano. We're not in Japan. The forum selection provision should govern this dispute, and arguably we should be in Japan. But K-Line and Union Pacific brought the action in the United States District Court. Moreover, the forum provision, there's also an applicable law provision which provides that Japanese law governs. They have not argued in this court or the district court that Japanese law governs. So what you have is less a principled view of the importance of Kirby and the trilogy to intermodal transportation, and really plaintiffs who are picking and choosing among provisions of agreements that ultimately suit their needs. One issue that I do think is important to address, because it's a question that's asked in both Union Pacific's papers and K-Line's papers, is, well, who should be responsible? Plano and Union Pacific sued all of the parties who were involved in the carriage of goods. They settled the case with World. They settled the case with CMT. They sued Kunshan, the manufacturer of the goods, and also THI. There's no shortage of parties who ultimately can bear the burden and the responsibility for the damages arising from the derailment. But there's nothing that compels this court to find that Plano is that party. And again, while we could quibble as to whether Plano is a pure, mere purchaser of goods, the rule that the plaintiffs would have this court adopt, the appellants would have this court adopt, is that anyone with a future interest in the goods, anyone, even a party that the plaintiffs, the appellants, would recognize is the purest of mere purchasers, would nevertheless be liable to indemnify for this derailment. So if they're speaking in terms of the broad policy principles that they believe Kirby and Great Northern and Regal Beloit stand for, we need to follow it to its logical conclusion. And what they're saying is that anyone who falls under the definition of merchant, which includes any party with a future interest in the goods, could ultimately be hauled into court as a defendant and be held liable for the massive damages suffered in connection with the derailment. So the question is, was the Supreme Court in Kirby, Regal Beloit, or in Great Northern prepared to go that far? They didn't. They clearly didn't. And the plaintiffs, the appellants, recognize that. What they want this court to do is to go further than Kirby did. And we submit that this court should not do that. If there are no further questions, I would ask that this court affirm the decision of the district court in all respects.
Mr. Mead, you have 2 minutes. I mean, perhaps you might start off by responding with what you would consider the limiting principle with regard to the assertion made by Mr. Wasserman on how broadly.
Counsel misstates the rule we're asking for totally. We're not talking about future interest here. The first thing you have to do is look at the facts of this case and read the bills of lading. One of the reasons Plano is liable here is because they were the named consignee under the World Bill of Lading. And named consignee is one of the people who is within the definition of merchant. Now, in the deposition, one of the witnesses for World said, oh, no, that was a mistake. But did you know it was in there? Well, yes. Did you ever change it? No. They were the named consignee on the document. No one ever changed it. All we're asking for is the Kirby rule, that where someone hires an intermediary, that person who hires the intermediary is responsible for the contracts the intermediary makes. And Regal Beloit said, quote, as in Kirby, The terms of the bill govern the party's rights. The red light seems to have come on.
No, that you've got another minute.
Another minute. So Regal Beloit didn't restrict the rule that the person who hires the intermediary is responsible. Second, on DDP, we're being asked to prove a negative here. DDP terms were never agreed upon between CMT and Plano. Never. There is nothing in this record. All it was, as we say, a gleam in the eye of World and Plano. They never did anything about it. And if Plano can prove at trial that somewhere there's a document showing the terms were DDP, maybe that will make a difference. But that's why summary judgment cannot be granted in this case. It's rife with factual disputes. Credibility has nothing to do with it. There are direct, dead-on factual disputes in this case. Even aside from the fact that most of the facts that we think are undisputed support our position. As far as policy is concerned, of course, we're not talking about future interests, but as far as policy is concerned, Kirby recognized we can't open every container. It would be not just disruption. It would be a disaster. It couldn't ever be done. We bring in 500,000 containers a year into this country, just us, Kalon. You can't stop commerce and look and see what the people who engineer the transaction, who are the Polonius behind the curtain, did or didn't do with regard to the loading of the container. Fact issues everywhere here, and that's why the fundamental reason that summary judgment cannot lie.
Thank you, Mr. Meade.
Well, thank you, Your Honor, for your attention.
Well, you have a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. The one point that I want to address first is the Bill of Lading. Mr. Wasserman mentioned the fact that the Bill of Lading gave equal footing to all parties with respect to what was in the container. That is not accurate. All it does is provide a description of the two different crates and what's being shipped. It does not provide any information with respect to how that weight has been placed or distributed within the container itself. Something that Plano, with its contacts through CMT, World, and its involvement in the shipping, was in a unique position to have that knowledge.
How would they know how the distribution weight would affect shipping? That's not Plano's business. They might know how it would fit on a factory floor or something like that. But
they certainly thought enough to decide what size container to get based upon the weight. I don't think it's too much to ask an engineer to think about how much that weight is going to affect when it's in one single spot.
Mr. Waller, what about, isn't part of the problem here the bracing? In other words, the container inherently isn't a problem, and I guess the weight standing alone isn't a problem. It's something occurred either in the shifting. I don't want to get into the specifics because I'm not sure
that's part of this record, Your Honor. And with respect to the actual cause of the derailment and what caused the molds to go through the floor, that's truly not an issue before this court. The issue with respect to the negligence issues, was there a duty? And based upon the facts and the case law that is cited by Plano and the exceptions noted in those cases, it's our opinion that there was at least an issue of material fact with whether or not a duty existed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Well,
appreciate it.
Thank you to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.